really wanted to start with questions and answers, because every time that we've done that for the last 10 minutes, I don't really feel like we get to finish. So, Annette's right in there.
Yes, I was really happy to hear Lahiri read from that chapter on the resurrection of Sri Yukteswar, because I've read the autobiography quite a few times, and I just finished reading it a few months ago, and I got to that chapter, and it just kind of blew me away. I kept saying, wow, oh my goodness. And mm-hmm. I've heard about these bodies for I don't know how long, but never figured them out or understood, or not, I won't say that I really understand, but right. I think I have a better understanding finally of right. these bodies. And my question is, we come from the causal all the way down to the physical.
Right.
When we die, we go back the same way.
Right.
But we have to finish on this earth. So when Master says, or someone says, they've attained freedom, is that only from this earth plane, or is that all the way to home?
Depends on whether they've attained freedom from just this earth plane or all the way home. So let me sort of give context to what you said, because you've studied these teachings longer, so I want to give everybody else the opportunity to understand what we're talking about. Autobiography of a Yogi, if you haven't read it, please read it. It's your homework assignment for the rest of your life. And the chapter called The Resurrection of Sri Yukteswar, do you know what number it is? Anyway, The Resurrection of Sri Yukteswar is a really, really, really good chapter. And I'm not going to read from it, I was just going to point it out. And he really comes back from the astral world and just talks about it. I mean, there's paragraphs in there. He talks about mermaids and leprechauns and fairies. I asked Swami Kriyananda, like, after I'm a human being, am I a mermaid? Do I then go be a leprechaun? And he actually gave a very interesting answer, separate lines of development. You know, if you're a fairy, you're not necessarily a person. If you're a mermaid, you're not ever necessarily a human being. Master also said that people reincarnate. Okay, I'm going to give context here, because this is the world beyond. This is exactly what the class is about. We're dealing with two realities. There is the physical world. This is the physical world. It's an objective world. We look with the telescopes. We see the stars up there. We find all these other planets. We find all these conditions on these planets. We're building spaceships. We're going to zip around through the physical world. Right now, we're more or less bound to the Earth. But we won't always be, because we're going into a higher age of more advanced technology, which we see, we now can go around this globe really very easily, whereas 100, 150 years ago, we couldn't at all. I remember the first time you could send a fax, and I was, you know, there putting this piece of paper in here, and then in a very short order, they were reading it in the hotel in Calcutta. I mean, it was amazing. And, you know, that piece of paper wasn't going through, but it was just so astonishing. But now the whole sense of this globe is so small. We instantaneously, you can use the Skype thing, and you're just looking at someone, and they're any place at all on the whole planet. And 150 years ago, that would be absolutely unheard of. But what it is that we're in an age of advancing technology, and Yogananda and others tell us, we'll just keep doing this faster and faster. So the time's going to come when the solar system, the galaxy, just like the science fiction movies, is just as accessible to us as planet Earth is right now. But even if we go way, way out to other planets, it's still the physical plane. We're still in physical bodies. We're still doing physical things. We're still obeying physical laws. They might discover more subtle physical laws, but it's still all physical. And everywhere you go in creation, life forms are essentially the same. This is what the masters say. I wouldn't be able to say that on my own authority. And it's all based on the star in the center of the spiritual eye. I believe I said this at one point, because that image is the image that precedes our manifestation. It's always going to be essentially a five-pointed star, two limbs and a head, with the highest state of consciousness here in the head. And so the mermaid, the leprechaun, the fairy, they're all based on this same model. They may manifest in very different kinds of bodies, and Swami raised the thought that you go through your whole evolutionary cycle as a mermaid rather than as a human being, but fundamentally it's still the five-pointed star. Of course, it's the fish tail, but nonetheless, it's still got those 5 points, just like the dove, which is the Christian symbol. So it's really important to just keep that in mind. No matter how far out the physical plane gets, it's still just the physical plane. Now, the other reality is what we call the astral world. And when Sri Yukteswar comes back, he's not talking about the physical plane. He's talking about the astral world. The astral world does not exist in physical space. This is very hard for us to understand. It's a vibration of energy, which they say is right here. And those people who have the capacity to see could stand in this room and from this space look into the astral world. That's why when Connie's father is dying, he sees a reality. Because he's moving out of his physical body, he's moving into his astral body, and when he's in his astral body, astral realities become discernible to him. But they're not vague, they're not cloudy, they're just not visible with the physical eyes. And in fact, it's the reverse, according to the way the masters tell us. The physical world is kind of vague and dreamlike. I mean, just think about it. We were all in there talking just 10 minutes ago. Can anyone really clearly, you know, reconstruct what was going on, what you were saying, what you were thinking, what you were feeling? Oh, vaguely, I remember we talked a little bit about this, but we don't relive it. It's gone. And think about your childhood. Think about a week ago. It's really very dreamlike in this world. And they say that in the astral world, it's much more vivid. You know, everything, the colors are vivid, more vivid, sounds are more vivid, feelings, both positive and negative, are more vivid because it's the source from which this one comes. And by the time it gets manifested here, it's heavy, it's got this body around it, it's looking out with its senses. Just as we know when we have an intuitive understanding, it's often so much stronger than just a thought you have about something. I know several times in my life I've had strong intuitive feelings about things, and I can't change my mind merely because I have reasonable objections to it later. Because the reasonable objections don't have the same force that the intuition had. I can't change it unless something of comparable force comes. And I'm sure all of you have had those same experiences, or at least every once in a while. Some people have them all the time. Now, we as physical beings actually have three dimensions within us, even though we're mostly just conscious of the physical, and we're very much like beings encased in a bottle. You know, there's the innermost circle, which is the causal circle. There's the second circle, which is the astral. There's the third circle, which is the physical. And we have this strange idea, because this one seems like the biggest one, that this is the strongest and the most important. We put it like this just so we can visualize it, but the power really comes from the center. And this here becomes more and more vivid. It's vivid. This is the causal world. It's vivid in the astral world. It's out here to the material world. And when our physical body dies, the way they describe it, this is the whole ocean of spirit, the infinite here. But when the physical body dies, we don't merge into the ocean of spirit. We simply take off one layer. Just literally, like if you were a bottle within a bottle within a bottle in the ocean, you can break one bottle, but there's still going to be another bottle there. And that bottle will continue to float. In the death situation, when you're in this bottle, you're looking at the physical world. And the physical world, people can see you and you can see them. When that physical garb is taken away, you're in the astral body. And as I was saying when I talked about karma, the astral body is where the chakras exist. And the chakras take the form in the physical body of the spine and the nervous system. But they start from the energy field here. And then more subtle even than energy is thought. And this is how, when I was describing it, when I was talking about karma, we wanted to model, redecorate the inside of this building. It used to be all brown, and it was done by the priests, and it was done really cheap, and it was done to look very austere, and it was brown, 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 everywhere, brown. And it had brown pews. And we had the thought that that isn't the building that we wanted. And then step by step, we put out the energy, which took the form both of manpower and money, to gradually manifest a completely different room. And so we begin as a thought, and we are actually a thought of the divine. Then more energy is put into it, and then there's a blueprint, which is the chakras, and then finally we manifest the physical body. But what we have to understand is the farther we get away from the source, the weaker and more dim we become, and the less we actually look like our true self. Because our true self is pure light. And the more layers we add onto that, the more dim that light becomes. Just exactly. Like, you know, if I'm a bright light inside and I put a piece of canvas over that and I put another piece of canvas over that and I put another piece of canvas over that, you might not even know that that light's there. And as I take off those layers, then the light gets brighter and brighter. So we live in this physical world, many people having no idea who they are or really what they are. Some people have a vague idea. And we might think, you know, I'm a greater, bigger being. I am a child of light. I am bliss. I am love. We take off a layer of canvas, the physical body, and we say, oh my gosh, look! Like my mother, when she actually took off her physical body, she was so committed to the idea of being old and sick that even though she wasn't even wearing her physical body anymore, I believe, she went to the astral body and just held on to that thought so strongly that it took quite some time before she was able to release it and look young again. Interestingly, the masters all tell us that most of the time in the astral world, we have a body that looks about 30. 25 or 30. I guess that's just the ideal moment before the whole thing just begins to go downhill. Sri Yukteswar said he was unusual because he kept an old appearance, right? Because I think then we're young and we're vibrant and we look our best and the smile's there. Who knows? I contemplate that sometimes when I look in the mirror. Well, when I'm in the astral world, I'll look 25 again. So our freedom, use the word freedom. Freedom is actually, you know, self-definition. The antithesis of freedom, or the fact that conditions our freedom, is self-definition. And I said when I was talking about karma, who am I? What is lastingly real? Where does my happiness come from? If your physical body dies, but you haven't changed your self-definition at all, you attain no particular freedom by dying. Because you don't attain freedom just by changing your clothes. You only attain freedom by changing your self-definition. And if you are so defined by your physical body, your senses, the desires that you have, the relationships that you have, the position you have in the world, you can take off your physical body and you get a kind of master called a gray dream in the astral world, but you never wake up because you don't know how to perceive without physical senses. And Master said you kind of rest and you just rejuvenate a little because you get a break. You never really wake up until you have another physical body. So nothing, you accomplish nothing by dying. Among the many reasons why suicide is just a waste of time and energy is that you don't get anything that you want. If it worked, it would be fine, but it does nothing for you. In fact, even more intently, it affirms your self-identification with all the experiences that you just went through because you hate them so much or fear them so much, you're willing to destroy yourself to try to get rid of them, and then the self-definition becomes even more intense rather than lightened. So how you think about yourself, and it's nice if you think explicitly as a yogi about God and the astral world, but if you just think about love, generosity, happiness, kindness, all of these qualities are more subtle dimensions of consciousness. So people can be avowed atheists and still go to very refined astral worlds because their actual vibration of consciousness is very refined. Because this is not a question of, you know, bribing the man at the door. This is, we move out of the physical plane, we go to the world of vibration, and as Sri Yukteswar explains it, like attracts like. Whatever your actual vibration is when you take off your physical body, you just blend right into that reality. And you're as free as you are. As Swamiji has emphasized so many times, nothing happens when you die. That's what he says. Nothing happens. Nothing at all happens because you're inside your consciousness and you're inside your consciousness. And your consciousness is wearing this coat and then it takes this coat off, but nothing happens. You know, we're all going to go home probably and take these clothes off and put on our pajamas. And I love being in my jammies. You know, it's the end of the day. I'm going to get to meditate and curl up in my little bed. It's a very happy moment for me. But I'm still the same person. You know, I sometimes think that going to the astral world might be a little bit like living in Hawaii for a while. But only if that's the vibration that you're in. And interestingly, Swami writes, there's a book which is out of print, but you can buy it through Amazon. And it's called How to Be a Channel. And it's by Swami Kriyananda. And it's an extremely explicit description of the astral world. We don't have it here, but you can get it for a few dollars. And basically he said, everything you see here exists because the blueprint is in the astral world, just like our chakras. But everything is more. So it's more beautiful. And the other thing about the astral world that makes it really, really nice is that whereas here, the vibrations are heterogeneous, meaning that good people and bad people can live right next door to each other. And bad people can invade the space of good people and then do bad things to the good people. I mean, lots of really horrible things happen here because it's a heterogeneous place. In the astral world, because it's only vibrations, the lower vibrations cannot invade the higher vibrations. The higher vibrations can go into the lower vibrations, and people who desire to help in this world remain exactly the same and desire to help in that world. And you generally help someone who is on the rung of the ladder below you. So higher vibration people can go into lower vibrations and help try to uplift them. But people of lower vibrations can't disrupt the experiences of people on higher vibrations, which is nice. And it's nice to think about. But one of the problems with the astral world is that it's very, very pleasant. Can be very pleasant if you're a refined person. I know when our friend Linda Gerber died, she used to take over the decorating of this church on holidays. And, you know, she had an extraordinarily expansive sense of beauty. She would bring in all these huge trees and all these lights. I mean, she just loved this huge space, and she would decorate all of it. And her own home was really lavish and beautifully decorated, and she had put on her tombstone, beauty, love is beauty, and beauty is love, or something very close to that. When she was dying, because she died of brain cancer, and so there was a nice run-up to the time when she finally left the body and lots of time to process, Swami Kriyananda came to visit her in the last few months of her life. I don't think it was at the absolute end. And she said, tell me about the astral world. And he talked about all the beautiful things that she would see and how satisfying it would be to her with her lovely sense of beauty. And then he said, but your danger is that you're going to like it so much there that you're not going to aspire to anything greater. That you're just going to sort of lean back and enjoy it. Leaning back and enjoying it is not spiritual progress. Leaning back and enjoying it is just another form of self-definition, which is a little prettier than this one, but you're not free, to use that word. You're attached to beauty. And it's nicer to be attached to refined things. Swamiji said, those of us who long for beautiful music, beautiful sights, beautiful refined experiences are much more satisfied in the astral world because you experience it as vibration all through you. And there are astral choirs and astral artists and, you know, astral landscape and astral flowers. Sri Yukteswar talks about how the inhabitants of the astral world can make astral trees and they can bring out any flowers that we want, and we can have astral sunsets, and we can make astral rainbows, and I mean, it just sounds great. But it could be too much fun. because we're not necessarily expanding our self-definition, because just as we know in this world, we can become just as trapped by our positive experiences as we can by our negative ones. Isn't that so? And even though it's more pleasant, it doesn't necessarily mean it's more expansive.
But it's not negative.
No, it's not bad. Nothing is bad. Everything is a question of self-definition. Now, the way Master puts it, Swamiji talks about a certain sadhu he met in India who said, you shouldn't enjoy anything in this world. And he said, Swamiji sort of, you know, just to go along with him, he said, well, what about a beautiful sunset? Not even a beautiful sunset. You shouldn't enjoy anything. Well, that is an approach. And that approach is, I will reject everything about this world and I will only concentrate inside. Swamiji said, fortunately, that wasn't the way Master taught. That wasn't what Yogananda taught. He said, enjoy everything, but enjoy it from inside yourself with God as a manifestation of God. And that's a very different way. So you don't just enjoy the sunset, but you enjoy the inner expansive feeling of bliss that the sunset gives you. And so Swamiji said, people talk about Yogananda. He loved mangoes. He liked India. He liked this kind of music. Swamiji said, Master loved and enjoyed everything, because what he was always experiencing was his own state of inner joy, and then he was able to see that expressed in all directions. If you're attached to it, see, what you have to be attached to is the flow of consciousness that can manifest as this. If you become attached to this form, then sooner or later that form will dissolve. That's the nature of form. I love my mother. I love my husband. I love my child. I love my dog. But what you're really experiencing is that all of these things allow you to have this certain experience. And we think that experience is coming from here, but it's always coming from inside ourselves.
So there would be a sense of less than if you've got, suppose you get there and everything's just as lovely as you could possibly imagine.
Right.
And so you're very comfy and you just kind of
right.
Wallow there and you say, okay, this is it. I'm happy to stay here. But then is it going to progress to a point where you feel, there is something wrong?
Well, you'll feel bored. Or what actually happens is, they speak of it this way, just in exactly the same way that your physical life ends at the moment that your physical karma expires. You know, you're in this form. See, there's a higher power than just our own opinions going on here. It isn't just a question of what the ego thinks is a good idea. It's what the soul knows is necessary for its destiny. We are the river seeking the sea. And even though we love going through this particular valley, whatever valley we're in is not our goal. Our goal is to get to the sea. So we have within us karmas that are unfinished, desires that are unfinished, desires that require us to be in the astral world to finish them, desires that require us to be in the material world to finish them. Maybe we have sexual desires. Maybe we want pizza. Maybe we like cigarettes. Maybe we like a nice drink after dinner. Maybe we like coffee. Maybe we want to be a famous violinist. Maybe we want to be rich. Maybe we want the house by the sea. Every single desire that you have registers in your chakras and sits there. It doesn't go away. Some of those desires can be fulfilled in the astral world, but not all of them. So the desires that can be fulfilled in the astral world, we have a certain span of astral karma. Just from the last time we were in the astral world and all the things that we wanted. And our astral world looks like whatever we want it to look like. This book that was referred to, Testimony of Light, as I recall, I'm not sure that I'm right about this, but I believe she lived in a little cottage somewhere in the astral world. She made in the astral world what her idea of heaven would be. I heard another, whether it was true or not, another channeled story where the grandfather comes back and he's talking to the granddaughter, and the granddaughter says, where's grandma? Oh, she's sitting at the feet of God singing hymns with the choirs. You know, now, I don't even know if the book was true, but her picture of heaven would be like that, and that's, you know, that would be it. If yours is a cottage by the sea, you have a cottage by the sea. But what happens is, just as, think about it from what you already know, because it's everything is consistent all the way through. You go down, let's say you go on a holiday. I have never reached the end of my ability to vacation, but I've heard that people do. You know, you're out by the ocean, you're living, you're doing something, you're doing nothing at all, and after a while you just get a little restless to be busy again, right? So you're in the astral world, you have your little cottage by the sea, you're listening to beautiful music, you're going every week to hear the angel choir sing, and after you do this for 100 or 200 or 700 years, you get a little restless because you have other internal desires that need to be fulfilled, and then all of a sudden, wham, there's a flash of light in the astral world and you're in somebody's womb. And there you are, starting the whole thing all over again. Who has the microphone? Let me give it. Does that make sense? That's really exactly how it works. You know, you think of it in this world too. You decide you're going to stay home and meditate. And then all of a sudden you think, but maybe if I had a pizza first. Then you go out and get the pizza and then you see that movie's playing and you don't really exactly know how you got there, but some little desire just wiggled up and moved you. That's why, Yogananda says, that's why the baby cries when it's born. Oh my God, here I am again. How did I get here? The question was, do you have to come back to planet Earth? Can you negotiate? Can you negotiate? You have to talk. You have to talk right in the top.
Did you want to go to a different dimension, planet Earth? Can you walk
down? Swami Kriyananda asked Yogananda that. When we reincarnate, do we always reincarnate on the same planet? He actually laughed and said, oh no, he said, there's countless planets that you could go to. If you kept coming back to the same planet, you'd find out too fast. Those are his words. You know, you would just get the drill too quickly. What does that mean about other planets? When he was asked directly, are there other inhabited planets? His response was, the universe is teeming with life. He said, we'll soon find that out. What is the nature of those other planets? I don't know. You know, he spoke of planets that are closer to the sun, where the people's bodies are just more gases and people are very tall. Raghu, who just absolutely loved hot weather, said that his previous incarnations were on a planet much closer to the sun. Was his point of view. He was just really used to some gaseous planet where things were boiling all the time, so he loved to go out into the desert here. So that is just like, God knows, but there it is. It's on.
I seem to remember a passage in the resurrection chapter about how Sri Yukteswar was going to help people through their astral karma. Uh-huh. And I was just wondering if the same is true for us. Can we expect a guru relationship in that realm as well, that we've taken discipleship?
Oh, it yes. The question is, you know, does the guru discipleship relationship extend into all the universes? Absolutely. All the levels of reality. The master is beyond astral, causal, and physical. He's transcended all three worlds. And so his consciousness is with us through that whole cycle. And once that bond is truly formed, then it never breaks. And it's with us until we ourselves have dissolved all three levels of reality and have become like the master, which is one with the infinite sea. The bubble becomes the ocean. You know, eternity and I, one united ray. And so, yes, master just moves through those worlds just effortlessly. And there comes a point, which is what Sri Yukteswar talks about, when we just don't have any physical karma left. We've become so refined that this world just doesn't interest us. And then we apparently, see, mostly we go back and forth between the astral and the causal, astral and the physical, with varying degrees, we, meaning everybody on the material plane, with varying degrees of consciousness in the astral world, depending on how capable we are become of perceiving on a subtle level. You can walk down the street and see lots of people who are going to pretty much sleep through the astral world. You know, there's nothing to be unkind. It's just a fact, though. You know, anything beyond the most, you know, tangible physical reality just doesn't exist for them. And then you see other people who are so delicate. Are so refined. You know that they're going to have a really rich and expansive experience in the astral world. And then we bring that back. We bought the community when the investors who own the community bought it. I wish we owned it ourselves, but we don't. When they bought it, it was, everything in it was, well, brown. It was really brown. It was really dark. The rugs were dark. The walls were dark. The curtains were dark, and then we'd go in, and then people had dark stuff in there. And then they kept the windows closed, and then their light bulbs were dull. It's like they were, and they were, you know, druggies and vagrants, and the police had to come really often. I mean, it was the neighbors loved it when we moved in there. I mean, it was the police were there 3 or 4 times a week to the place where we now live. It was like it was already dark, and then the people in there, their idea of what things should be was dark. And the first thing we did was, you know, open the windows, paint it light, you know, increase the wattage of the bulbs, take out the dark. And all of a sudden, because that's the astral world we're recreating. Our astral world is blue and lavender and yellow. It's not black. And I mean, that's why I get so annoyed when everybody comes dressed in black. You know, that's not the astral world that we came from. The astral world we come from is light. That's who we ought to try to be. Does that make sense? Yeah.
What is the difference between spirit and soul?
The problem is English.
Okay.
The difference between spirit and soul is just how we define them. In English, there are no exact words. That's the same question of what is the level of freedom? Well, it's whether you're a siddha or a paramukta or a jivanmukta. I mean, in Sanskrit, there's exact words for exact levels of freedom. In Sanskrit, there's exact words for different things. In English, Master made up words like lifetrons, you know, and things like that, because he didn't want to make it Sanskrit, but there were no real true words for it. So I use the word, and you've heard me use it, the word jiva, because jiva is our individual bubble of consciousness. And you could call that word soul, but soul also can mean the infinite. So jiva really is your little unique individuality. But the jiva expands its self-definition until it has become infinite. But it's the little bubble that now floats in the great sea. But it's still the little bubble, but it also has identified with the great sea. Yeah, so it's hard. You can't pin it down in English. We have because people speak of soul evolution. Well, does the soul really evolve if the soul is infinite? You know, it's just convenience in the English language.
You explained once before, but I'd like for you to tell me again.
Okay.
How is it that a person can be on the physical plane and yet working on higher levels of karma? So you can be on the physical plane and yet working on astral karma or causal karma?
Well, think of it like this. If you're a prince in a fairy tale and you were of royal blood, and you wandered off and you got lost and you ended up being raised by a shepherd out in the stable, your royalty has never been touched by the fact that you have identified yourself and grown up as a stable boy. And the power of your kingdom and your potential to be a ruler is still being developed, even though you're not aware of it anymore, because it's inherent within you. What has shifted only is your self-definition. So we have defined ourselves and identified. Ego is the soul identified with the body. And that means the astral body, the physical body, or the causal body. That's why mere death doesn't make you free. Ego is the soul identified with the body. And when you become identified, you don't remember your other reality. It's not that it ceases to exist. It's just that you don't remember it. You don't remember it with the part of you that has become identified. But the only part of you that has become identified is actually a little bit of your consciousness. Your connection to the infinite, your royal blood, is not severed merely because you're not looking over there. That's why we use the word realization. You know, if you're sitting in a room reading, let's say, and you're real quiet, and somebody walks into the house and doesn't see you there, and then you, if you're kind of a mischievous type, you know there's going to be the moment when they notice you, or that you're going to be able to say, boo, and that person is really going to jump. Nothing will have changed. It's just they were unconscious of something and they become conscious of it. So we're unconscious in our everyday awareness of what's happening on higher levels. But that doesn't mean it's not happening. It just means we don't know it. And of course, when we're in the physical body, we're primarily working on the in the realm of the physical. But simultaneously, things are shifting on higher levels, especially if we meditate, if we've attracted a guru, if we have the grace of God. How and how much I wouldn't possibly know. But when death comes, or when these out-of-body experiences happen that everybody's talking about, you realize it was never what it seemed. That's the most amazing thing about it. Everyone who goes into that state realizes, how could I have forgotten? It's just so stunning. How could I have forgotten? And then oftentimes what will happen in the last days of a person's life is they'll visit that realm. And then when they come back, they have a completely different relationship to dying. Because they'd forgotten for the last 25 or 40 or 70 years that they actually don't belong here. And they'd become so identified with it that they thought they belonged here. And then all of a sudden you realize, oh, I'm just visiting. You know, I'm going to my other home now. What's the big deal? When my friend Linda Gerber died, it was a very, it was actually very, very touching. She was a very beautiful woman. She had a beautiful home. She had a beautiful family, husband, two children. I mean, just really lived very nicely in this world. And when she really found out that she wasn't going to recover, because it was a cycle of recurring cancer that metastasized, and she way outlived what everybody expected. And just by intuition, the day the doctor really finally told her, there's nothing more we can do, I just dropped in to see her. So I caught her right in that moment, and she was weeping, and she looked at me, and she sort of said, I know this sounds silly, but I really thought I was going to get better. Even though all evidence to the contrary, she had just still held that thought. And now she was really, for the first time, having to accept that she wasn't going to get better. And she kind of gestured, we happened to be alone, she kind of gestured the whole house and referred to her husband and her children, how can I leave all of this? It was just like her heart was breaking. How can I leave all of this? And I said to her, I prayed, you know, what should I say? And I said, well, you know, you have a valley of tears you have to walk through. But you will walk through it, and on the other side of it, you will find blissful light. I promise you. You have to walk through it, but on the other side. You know, a few months later, when she's on her deathbed, oh, she says, you were right. You know, you were right. Because by then, she was identifying her self-definition had become where she was going. And her self-definition, because her poor body was ravaged by that point, and, it, you know, it just wasn't an attractive thing to identify with anymore, she began to, her self-definition became what she was seeing. And she never really explicitly said, spoke of the astral world, but, you know, she was just very happily floating somewhere. And it was just, what's the big deal here? Now my self-definition has become this, and everybody will be all right. It wasn't like she was anxious to leave them, but this is the way things are. I forgot. And now I remember. Because almost everyone who leaves their body doesn't want to come back. And then something pushes them back in. And, you know, it hurts people's feelings. Mommy, didn't you want to come back to me? Well, it's not that I didn't want to come back to you. It's that I realized that I never left you. That's very hard to explain, because from here we can't see both sides. From there you can see both sides. One man speaking about this says, well, doesn't my mother miss me? I miss her. He said, time is different there. And what feels to you like a long separation is just a moment like that. So what is there to mourn? If I walk out of the room, you know, nobody's going to get really upset because I'm going to come back. And that's how it looks from there, so they tell us. Unless you're so identified with this plane that you can't go there. And that's when you get caught. You become a ghost, or you go into a darker world. And people who are really, really mean and horrible, you don't have to worry about mean and horrible people. You don't have to do anything about it, because they're in hell already. And as soon as the physical body is removed, they get to live in their consciousness. And it ain't pretty. So it takes care of itself. They'll sort it through. But if you become angry, then you get trapped in their world. I believe, I don't know if it was the book that Vicki was referring to or not, but there's some book that includes the story of, I think it was a Nazi who murdered this woman's family, and she hated him so much that she was in hell with him because that was her obsession. There was another story that was told by this man who could see ghosts and entrapped beings, and he would go through our apartments and he would help free astral beings that were caught in those spaces. I have no idea what that means. I mean, like, they're physically caught in my apartment? How could that be? But he would feel the energy. And he told this story, whether it's true or apocryphal, it's an interesting story. He said, in this particular corner of my apartment, which had always had a sort of dead energy to it, an odd energy, he found an American Indian, you know, on a horse, who'd been killed in a battle right after he had seen his daughter die and had, was so distressed that he couldn't protect her, and then he was killed. But he died in this state of tremendous sadness and despair, not merely because she had died, but because he hadn't been able to protect her. And he was sitting on his horse looking down, and my psychic friend said, his daughter was right here, trying to get his attention and tell him, look, it's fine, we're just dead, it's no problem. You know, you don't have to feel this way. It all happened the way it was meant to happen. And my friend said that he was able to get the American Indian to look up. That was all that was required, because as soon as he looked up, he saw his daughter. And then he left. And he was no longer trapped in that attitude. But whatever attitude you're trapped in, when you die, you get to keep it, which is a very strong incentive for what I call staying karmically current. You know, don't let things build. Don't cling to wrong attitudes, because when you die, you get to keep them. Bummer. That is the definition of bummer. Yeah. Stacey has a question.
Excuse me. Do we have the ability to transcend? We can't send our attitudes when we're in the astral world?
Oh, yes. We keep growing in the astral world if we want to.
Okay.
We can keep growing in the astral world, sure. The difficulty in the astral world simply is that we can become complacent in the astral world. So souls who are serious, really serious about their spiritual growth, don't try to store up and live happily in the astral world. They're not looking for pleasure and enjoyment, you see. That's what we often talk about. Don't make the mistake that thinking that the ideal experience is pleasure and enjoyment, ease and pleasure. If your thought form is ease and pleasure and you find ease and pleasure, you'll cling to it. But that's just another self-identification. What you want is bliss. But if you're attached to ease and pleasure and you go into the astral world, you'll just hang out there and you'll get complacent until you get restless.
So we basically change or transform in the astral world from our own consciousness we're on. Whereas this world, sometimes pain or situations can push us.
I don't actually know. Sri Yukteswar speaks of the fact that in the astral world, what causes us pain is to be in any way out of tune with God. So the degree to which we're not perfectly attuned, that's how we suffer. And it depends how refined and sensitive we are, what that's about. We can continue to grow in the astral world. If we go into the astral world and think about ease and pleasure, then that's how we live. If we die with a tremendous desire to serve others, this is where service becomes extremely important. That's why an attitude of service is so helpful, because you see, one of the things you can carry to the astral world is an attitude of service. When my friend Paula was dying and she was on the phone with Swami Kriyananda, she said, I hope they have a job for me in the astral world. You know how I like to stay busy, she said on the phone. She was so sweet. And Swami said, I'm sure they have your place ready for you, Paula. Because she likes to stay busy and she's not interested in herself. She was and is, to the extent that she's still anywhere, is interested in sharing the light with others. Nothing happens when you die. If your commitment is not self-centered, but is, you know, in outward giving, you just continue exactly like that in the astral world. I didn't refer to it last week, but in the final exam, that essay that Swami wrote that's in the book called Religion in the New Age, he speaks about how sometimes when people die or come into the end of their lives, they become peaceful, but he said it's a passive peace. In other words, you're not being dynamic anymore. You're peaceful, but you're just like, you know, now I don't have to put out any energy. I can just kick back. And he said, it's not a good way to die. because you will just fall back through the medulla. You'll just drift back and you'll just be stuck in your ego again. It's not like you will, you know, try to get well when you are not going to get well. It's not like you have to deny the approach of death, but you have to always be reaching for the light because you don't want to die with a passive attitude. It will take you into a passive place and into a passive place the next time. You just can't cheat. There's no point at which it becomes effortless until you merge into the infinite. It always requires that you keep raising your energy level, whatever situation you're in. And when you have that really deeply imbued in you, and you live to give, then the astral world is just another field of service. It's nothing else. If you're always looking to be rescued and you want an escape, then you'll escape for a while to the astral world and it'll just be neutral. Religion in the New Age, it's a book it's by Swami Kriyananda, and there's an essay in it called The Final Exam, which is the subject of the last time I spoke, and it's very, very good. I don't know how much of that came off on the recording, but it was just a story about a man who went through hellish experiences in the Holocaust, but instead of going dark, he went bright. And the story was from that Dr. Ritchie had told. There's a book called Return from Tomorrow, which is really well worth reading. It's one of the best death and return stories there is. I had an interesting thought recently, and it was prompted actually by some of you know that my husband's sister died a couple of weeks ago. And she'd been sick for a few years and then really sick for a couple of months. So it was not a surprise that she died. And I was not emotionally involved with her, nor really was my husband all that much. But, you know, we're family, and so we were part of it. But it was just terrible for her husband. Her husband, they had met when they were 15 years old. They'd been married almost 50 years. And her daughter, too, the daughter and the father and the mother were really close. And the son was part of it, but especially those three. So we go down there for this gigantic Jewish funeral. And the Jews don't have any context for death, just none. You live right, you do a good job, you die, too bad. You know, they believe in the soul, but it's very vague. It sort of goes back to God, and the person lives on in the mitzvahs that you do, in the good deeds that you do. It's not very sophisticated. But the rituals are enormous, the system is really enormous. But, I mean, man, these people were suffering because this woman was, you know, just my age, and it was premature. And it was agonizing to just see when the cantor started with the Hebrew prayer for the dead and, you know, and this, they'd all heard it a zillion times for everybody else and now it was for their own loved one. You know, it was awful. And, you know, I'm ready to go there with it. You know, I'm very empathetic. I'm feeling all of this. And it was depressing me. And then all of a sudden, I realized, these are the experiences that bring you to God. Just as simple as that. I realized, here he is, they've been really good Jews, which is, you know, as things go, it was good, and we're just all these other really good Jews, but they'd run up against it. They'd run up against what happens, which is no matter how well you live, no matter how wealthy you are, no matter how well-respected you are in the community, this woman got this illness and she died. And as her husband said, it wasn't supposed to happen. But it does happen, friends, and this is what brings us to God. Lifetime after lifetime, we gradually figure out, I am not in control. And at first we become angry, then we become depressed, then we become suicidal, then we become crazy. We do all kinds of things, and we literally do all those things. And then gradually we get interested in what is really going on here. And so I remember Swamiji saying, when he sees people suffering, Swamiji says, what occurs to him is not that they're suffering, but how happy they'll be when they finally realize God. So their very suffering actually elevates his awareness because he thinks how much sweeter it will be when all this suffering ends. And it was amazing to me to be able to sort of use that and see their suffering, but realizing how positive their suffering was. Not that I would pass it off or be rude about it or not be sympathetic in the moment, but in my own heart, it was not tragic. because it was just simply a necessary stage. And they were not going to be able to go where they needed to go. The river was not going to be able to go into the sea without these experiences. And just the other day, I was thinking about death. Surprise. I was thinking about violent death, sudden death. I was thinking about Holocausts, genocides, children being killed in front of their parents. You know, just all the really horrible things that you can think about. And I was somehow, because it was just an idea, it wasn't a fact, I was just standing back from it a little bit and really impressing upon my mind, what's so horrible about death? What's even so horrible about a child dying? Because the child doesn't really die. The child just takes off the body. And all of the conversations we've had about watching people take off the body, there they are, they're breathing, they stop breathing, and the body is so like nothing at that point. It's so unattractive. It's so useless. It's so clearly unrelated to the person. It was literally just the clothes they were wearing. And we all know that, and yet somehow when somebody takes off their body, we have this obligation to feel anxious about it. And then I remembered that's exactly the conversation between Arjuna and Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita. Arjuna does not want to fight the war. His enemies are his own cousins, the people he grew up with. How can I kill these people? My uncle, my grandfather, my boyhood friends, how can I kill them? And Krishna says, oh, it's just all in your point of view. He says, you think that they die, you watch their bodies fall over. He said, I watch their souls liberated and rise. He said, what is this that you're mourning? And it's not an easy exercise, even just as a practice. I can't imagine what it would be like in person. But the fact of the matter is, they die. But nothing really happens. There's a story of a man in India who dreamt that he had 7 sons, and in his dream, all 7 sons were bitten by cobras and died. And he woke up in this state of extreme sadness that his sons had died, but then he realized it was a dream and there was nothing to be sad about. And then shortly after, his wife comes to him and says, our only son has been bitten by a cobra and has died. And the man is completely impassive. And the mother becomes irate. How can you be so unfeeling? Our only son has just died. He said, well, last night I lost 7 sons to cobras. Today I've lost another son. He said, I'm not sure which sons I should be mourning for. Now, of course, it's just an illustrative story, but it's not. It's also very, very true. Someone said in dinner that they were a little nervous about this class because it seemed kind of grim. And they were surprised about how much fun we've had. And I thought, oh, death is so much fun. You know, it really is, if we can handle it correctly. Our society is so ignorant and so confused. A man described it is that our society is riddled with greed. And the last kind of greed we have, he called life greed. When life is over, we're still greedy. We're just not able to just say, enough already. Whether it's, you know, ourselves or our loved ones, it's done. Everything ends. And so when we see examples like that man, we're awestruck. But it's a little bit like when they said to Mother Teresa of Calcutta, people say you're a saint. And instead of demurring and saying, oh, not me, she said, and why aren't you one? That was her response, like, this is our destiny, why are you not there? And it's really, these are, you know, sooner or later, we have to go there. So why waste all that time? Because all that happens then is that we get to suffer. What's the point? Sooner or later, we won't. Why not now? Well, any other questions?
Does that say then that we're better off going sooner rather than later?
No. No, actually, because you gain nothing by dying. What you have to do is you have to attain a new self-definition. And part of that self-definition is I am a child of God and wherever I am is exactly where he wants me to be. And if I cannot find joy right where I'm standing, where do I think I'm ever going to find it? God is no more or less present now than he will ever be in my life. It's entirely a question of my realization. There was a man who ran a seminar in for people who had terminal illnesses, they made two lists. I've said this before. One list was the things they were going to miss out on if they died prematurely. The other was the things they got to be rescued from if they died prematurely. And I did that, sort of tried to do that as an exercise, and I must say I was extremely pleased to realize I couldn't put anything on either list. I mean, I'm not that advanced, but I couldn't sincerely write anything because I thought, you know, there's no rescue, nothing will happen when I die, and there's nothing to miss out on because I'm always going to be exactly where I'm meant to be. I mean, that didn't mean I don't have desires and feelings and fears and lots of things I'd love to be rescued, but I just couldn't commit any of them to the paper. Because as soon as I did, I thought, you know, this life, next life, what's the difference? It's going to be now when it happens. And that, you know, when you get into that bhav, then that mood, that spiritual mood, I had a very difficult period when I had to face a really serious challenge that went on for quite a few years. It was very boring, extremely boring. But my incentive for it was, if I don't do it now, I'm just going to do it later. There is no rescue. And by just saying there is no rescue, then you just get serious. Because a huge amount of our energy goes into hoping that we'll be rescued. And when you really get, I will never be rescued, then you begin to relate to your life very, very differently. You can't overcome everything just by snapping your fingers. But at least you give up the thought that you're going to get out of this. Divine rescue. Rescue meaning I'm never really going to have to deal with this. It's just going to somehow, it'll just go away. You know, I mean, when I had to think about that, at a certain point in my life, Swami Kriyananda said to me, don't ever think about having another assignment. You know, you're in the Ananda Palo Alto and you'll probably die there. Not soon, but you'll probably die there. And then I really realized how many things I was hoping to get out of. People I didn't quite like that much, aspects of the job that I really didn't want to deal with, a corner of the garden where nothing would grow, you know, the mess in my closet. There were just so many things that subconsciously I just thought that sooner or later I'll get transferred. And when he just said, you're not going to get transferred, I realized, oh my God, why did he have to tell me that without my thinking about it? We're never going to get transferred because when we get transferred, we take it all with us. And if you don't like it now, I promise you, you won't like it more later. I think that we have to stop because we have another program, another part of the program. Okay. Go to different dimensions. Yeah, so in the causal world. No, it's not that arbitrary. You go to where your essential vibration is. Your last thoughts are a reflection of your essential vibration. It's not just the last minute. Well, that fear itself is, you can't solve it at the last minute. And when you're there, you do your best. And if you're helping people, you do your best. That's all you can do. I had to go to a hospital when they turned off the machine. And the man had been unconscious, and I thought he was going to be unconscious. He was wide awake and fully aware. And we were there at 10 of 3, and at 3 they were going to turn off the machine. I mean, he was remarkable. He was remarkable anyway. He hadn't been a particularly spiritual person. In fact, he was a very, very sensual person and a very materialistic one. But his true nature came out. It's been a great ride. Now it's over. He could, you know, so he just, that's how he died. He died, it was one of the really most impressive deaths I've seen. It depends, Romy. There's no... It completely depends on who you are and what you're... And you can't always tell from the outside. You know, a person can be deeply committed to the life they're living, but inwardly really be much more free than you may realize. And a person may appear to be free and really be much more deeply identified. It's absolutely fair. It's metaphysics. It just works the way it's meant to work. So work on it now. Because you're not going to be able at the last minute to shift it. We do have to stop, but yes. We're here for a purpose. Exactly. Right, all of that. Let's just get on with the job. We'll do it now. We'll do it in the astral world. We'll do it in the physical world. We'll do it in this body. We'll do it in the next body. We'll do it on planet Earth. We'll do it on planet whatever. Same story everywhere. No rescue. All right, we have to stop.